Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
From the campus of American University in Washington, D.C., a collaboration between American University's Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association's Environment, Energy, Markets, and Finance Committee. This is the Hot Air Show, your resource for debate and insight on carbon and energy policy, markets, and politics. I'm your host, Christopher Barron. In this show, we'll be looking into many of the international energy issues that are playing here in Washington, mainly what's going on in Japan as of this morning, and also what's been happening in the Middle East, and the questions of the global oil economy, domestic strategy, the such. We'll also spend some time talking about legislation moving on Capitol Hill currently that would preempt EPA from moving forward and continuing regulation on greenhouse gases. With that, I'm going to ask the panel to introduce themselves, and we'll get going with the debate.
Tyson Slocum, I direct the energy program at Public Citizen.
Kevin Book, I'm managing director of research at Clearview Energy Partners. We're a research firm that serves financial investors.
I'm Toby Short.
Well, Kevin, Japan last night, our time, had a pretty significant earthquake, the largest, I think they'd said, in over 100 years. And there have been some shutdowns in a number of the nuclear facilities in the country. All reports to date show that all the safety mechanisms appear to be working and so on, and looks like we're far from the worst-case scenario as of this time of taping. But in your view, what does even just the question of safety bring to bear on the debate as it's going right now in the United States?
Well, thanks, Chris, for the question, because I think it's in the context of discussing clean energy and reflecting on the fact that we have old infrastructure in the country. We need new infrastructure, and even though nuclear power is expensive, it runs for a long time and it runs clean, there's been a tremendous change. If you look at where our Congress is and the makeup of the Democratic Party itself, what used to be the biggest concern as an industrial pollutant has become a solution instead of a problem for a large number of Democrats in the Senate and for the president as well. And so it's in that context that the sudden reminder that, wait, it could still be a problem surfaces in Japan. First, the facts. The facts appear, as you say, to suggest that nothing went wrong, and that's great. That's exactly what everyone would hope for on a human level and a political level. But then the politics. The issue that comes up, whether it's the seismic stability of deposits put into in underground storage in Yucca Mountain, whether it's the dry cask storage above ground adjacent to sites here in the United States, whether it's the risk of being able to withstand a terrorist attack. And if you look at where we are in D.C. right now, Ed Markey has recently launched his own attack on one of the reactor designs that's gone before the NRC for approval on concerns that it lacks the integrity to withstand a direct impact from a jet. Without calling it out, Westinghouse, it would be the sort of thing where it's really a delicate time. We have this re-embrace of nuclear and some of the old concerns resurfacing at the hands of some of their oldest exponents, and now this. So I'll say this about that: if anything bad does happen, it crushes the nuclear renaissance in its cradle. The fact that something bad could happen is going to put a lot of headwind in front of the definition of clean. And I'd go so far as to say, actually, the big fight about the CES isn't what's in it when it passes, but what's in it when it's drafted. Who's clean? This is nuclear's chance to define itself or to be defined.
Tyson, in your view, where should nuclear fall out on the it's clean debate? I mean, we touched on the safety issues, and you've heard a lot of people describe Three Mile Island, for instance, as, you know, getting into an accident, having all the safety systems in the car work perfectly, you know, you walk out immediately after, turn around and say, that damn car, you know, I'm not too pleased with it. That's how some folks have characterized the safety record of the industry in the environmental movement as, you know, obviously closely linked with the waste issue. The worst thing that I've heard in terms of nuclear safety in this country in the last a year or so was the fact that rabbits appeared to be, you know, digging into dry casks up at Hanford. From your perspective, has nuclear tackled the safety issue? Does it deserve the mantle of clean?
No, it's not a clean energy source, and the industry hasn't adequately responded to some of the ongoing safety problems at the aging reactors, some of the challenges with the new designs for the next generation of reactors. And the fact is that the industry is digging its own grave with the escalating costs for their new reactors. And that's why you're starting to see some talk about going smaller with modular systems. Unfortunately, what's going on in Japan, where thankfully it looks like the nuke plants haven't had any problems related to the earthquake and the tsunami. But even if there were, it really wouldn't impact the debate in the United States because American policymakers don't really care what happens in other countries. I've seen an issue after issue where there are successes or problems with policies that are under debate in the United States, and it largely is irrelevant in the halls of Congress. But I think that the nuclear renaissance is going to continue to be delayed because of the soaring cost problems, and I just don't see that it's – I see it more as a distraction to figuring out how to address climate change and usher in the renewable technology revolution that the United States needs to engage in.
The renaissance that we've been talking about has been one that's been a long time coming. I mean, we haven't had any new builds or – significant uprights that could uprights that would constitute a new build in a long time. Is this a push of the industry trying to, as you say, come back out of a new cradle? Is it one that is going to ultimately get hamstrung by economic forces outside of its control? The austerity that we have in this country, budget consciousness, a natural gas price forecast that even though many of us who saw what happened at the turn of the century are wary of, has a better promise than many folks have seen in a long time to maintain gas prices between $6-$7 MMBTU for a significant period of time. Are these economic trends too much for such a capitally intensive build to overcome, even if once they get operating, the efficiency and the output of a nuclear plant, the air emissions characteristics and performance are really pretty important?
I mean, as an analyst, the answer is yes. The cost of nuclear power is prohibitive. Most of the plants we have now have actually been subsidized between 60% and 80% by governments of some sort. The operating profile for most of the publicly traded utilities is such that they'd have to put a substantial share of their market cap at risk to bear the risk by themselves. And even with the insurance policies that have been proposed, enacted, and ultimately implemented, there's still questions of managing the debt burden when you have unknown delays. So any uncertainty still makes it a very difficult choice for all but the biggest of utilities. The analyst in me so basically says, yeah, this is way too expensive, but the political sensitivity here is different. The Republicans have the heart for nuclear. They do not have the wallet. This group of Republicans is unwilling to subsidize big companies, and we haven't seen it yet, but when push comes to shove, you're going to find more populism in the Tea Party, we think, than many of the sort of the large old guard conventional Republicans may have expected. And then to the idealist in me, because Tyson's here, I'll bring him out. He's very small and not particularly well-spoken. But here are the facts. We have lousy infrastructure that's still operating because we can't build new. We find ways around to keep things running that we should have shut down a long time ago. It's not in the public interest. If you could get through some of the permitting hurdles and streamline some of this stuff, you might find that technologies like nuclear power that have tremendous environmental promise and potential economic yield might get built without so much hemming and hawing. We might actually have safer, better, cleaner power. What we need is reg reform. My idealist now departs.
Well, you know, that's interesting, Toby. I mean, a lot of times you hear that type of those type of themes carry preceding talk of, you know, the next energy moonshot, the next energy new deal, the, you know,
the Apollos,
you name it. Are we just in a period of time where, as some folks here in D.C. say, the election has already started, the campaigns have already started again, and, you know, this is the rhetoric that comes with it?
No, I don't think so. While we always have a perpetual campaign, I think that members actually want to solve some of the energy stuff, because energy, unlike a lot of issues, is actually a lot less partisan than it is regional. I mean, you saw that in climate debates, you see it in renewable portfolio standard debates, all these issues, Republicans and Democrats end up teaming together. One thing about the nuclear stuff, and Kevin, you alluded to this, that it could crush the cradle or crush the cradle or whatever. What if, after all that's happened in Japan this morning, nuclear turns out that nothing was wrong, all the safety mechanisms were in place, things like, and Tyson, you can answer this as well. Does that give the nuclear industry more credibility? And putting the financing aside, because you're right, you know, putting a market cap over the cost of a nuclear project in and of itself is, you know, somewhat cost prohibitive. But let's say all the redundancies and all the safety measures that were in effect in Japan made sure that nothing happened to those reactors. Does that give a leg up to the nuclear industry to say, all those that are worried about the safety of all these new things, look at what happened over here. When are we ever going to have an 8.9 earthquake and the tsunami that accompanied it? But yet, all the systems worked. It was safe. So let's get and do that reg reform. You know, do the licensing, things like that.
Well, Toby, that's the way I'd love to look at it. Look, it's been proven. It survived the acid test. The lesson from last year, looking at the oil spill, is that what gets people upset is the possibility of energy risk moving outside the immediate value chain of production. So coal accident, regrettable, sad, tragic, but localized. Gas well accident, if it gets into the water supply, major fears. Oil spill, crushing political risk. And nuclear is at the end of the list in terms of the continuum. And politically, it's the existence or the reminder of the risk that I fear will dominate the debate. It's not that we should ignore risks. I agree with you. I think that it would be wonderful if the conclusion was, look at how well-constructed new infrastructure is. Let's build some.
Right.
But what does Tyson think?
Well, I think that we shouldn't be basing our future energy policy on something that we always have to breathe a sigh of relief every time we avert a disaster. The fact is, as Kevin said, that a problem is always present with nuclear power, and that's very unique compared to other energy sources. And that's a reason why the Congress had to supply risk insurance to the industry, because the market has taken a look at this technology and said, we're not willing to stand behind and guarantee this risk. So the American public is forced to do it through the Price-Anderson Act. So I just think that nuclear ends up being a very expensive distraction away from public investments into the other technologies that just don't feature the kinds of huge problems that nuclear power presents.
Well, it's interesting because what we saw in the Middle East really did change what a lot of people expected of the dynamics of the debate coming into this summer. I think it's safe to say that there were a lot of people who at the start of the year said, this is not going to be a year for comprehensive energy bills. Energy bills that try to really get at the heart of some of our infrastructure issues, the energy systems issues that we have on a global basis. And, you know, we're going to take things on a piecemeal approach. In fact, even earlier this week, someone in the House, Mr. Cantor, I believe it was, Representative Cantor on the House side, said that he didn't think that we were going to have any type of comprehensive bills, that we were still going to go on a piecemeal approach. But since the unrest in Egypt and the spiking of global oil prices in excess of $100, A lot of folks have started to say that, look, we're entering what you could describe as an energy summer for legislation. This is the kind of conditions that breed comprehensive omnibus energy bills and so on. Now, it's still a big lift, as people would point out, the what would the House do, a view that people raise. But are we closer than we were previous crisis to potentially having a more consolidated package? We had the Speaker of the House just yesterday, you know, point out that he would like to see a number of different elements pass, not just we're going to take this and that's what we're going to focus on, but a number of different elements. Are we in a better situation than we were before for a energy summer with very, very active comprehensive legislation?
Well, I think anytime that, this is Toby, I think anytime that gas prices hit four, possibly, you know, north of $4 to $5 a gallon, that's a push to do something.
Yeah.
People can't sit on their hands.
Well, but the problem is, Tyson, is that the two parties are so far apart on their proposed solutions. I don't see politically how any common ground can be found, whether it's a piecemeal approach or anything big. You still have Republicans largely saying that expanding drilling is going to be the answer here. Democrats, have been talking about releasing supplies from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which again is nonsensical and not going to address anything. I'm not hearing enough people talk about giving clear instructions to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission about reining in speculators, which I think is the only thing that Congress can do to address short-term price increases.
They're trying to figure that one out
I'm unbuttoning my cuffs at this point, rolling up my sleeves for listeners.
The chance of this turning into an entirely Dodd-Frank discussion is imminent, and therefore let us turn to a different course.
Chris, can I answer?
Windfall profit.
Yeah, last question. Actually, Toby just mentioned the right thing. If you look at history, first of all, this economy runs on oil. All industrial economies run on oil. Not having oil makes energy law happen. And in fact, if you look at the history of our energy laws, it's only been supply disruptions that have ever caused big laws. 73 brought the 75 law and got us CAFE and the SPRO. 79 brought us 80 in the windfall profits tax. 91 brought us the relatively impotent but well-intentioned 92 Act. Mm-hmm. 01, the start of the century, with our gas, and 03 with our electric disruptions, brought us the 05 bill, which was poorly timed because weeks later Katrina came and brought us the preposterous moonshine target of ethanol in the 07 law. Mm-hmm. These are all disruption-driven laws. Everything else is futzing around with tax policy on the margins and good intentions or regulatory implementation. Now, here's the interesting thing. Last year and the year before, we were really close to passing a major energy law on the basis of essentially the economic weakness of the United States. There was a big bargain being drawn up in states, and especially in the Senate. All that regionalism Toby's talking about was coming together around a common economic self-interest. And there might have been a way to buy consensus for the first energy law that wasn't disruption-driven, but didn't happen, which tends to reinforce the thesis that you don't get one without a disruption. So where are we now? Well, hell, guys. We're closer to a disruption than we've been in a while. It just hasn't happened yet. And until it happens, I think we're going to be talking about, as the president's fond of saying, small ball.
Well, as Tyson points out, you could say that the parties are apart on what the solution is, even though the conditions are fostering doing something in public opinion to do something. Toby, you often have people saying, well, look at the biofuel economy. And what can be done there. Energy politics is regional resource-based politics. That's an area where we've frequently seen bipartisan support. Is that an area that you think is going to continue to grow, or is this debate going to get dominated by clean energy standard issues, Keystone Pipeline issues, and such?
I don't think it'll be dominated by clean energy standards, but I've had more than one member say $4 to $5 gas prices let you do a lot of things besides just oil drilling, opening up. And ANWR at this point is on the table because it resonates with people, because it's more domestic, more domestic fuel and more domestic development. I don't see ANWR going anywhere. I think that regardless of
how members of Congress, even if they started off anti-ANWR, even if they've seen ANWR and now fundamentally or down deep believe, well, there's no really reason not to drill there, they're so dug in that you know, that's more of a partisan type issue.
And the issue that I'm starting to see that's a little more concerning to me is this talk from many Republicans that the high energy prices we're seeing is a result of Obama's rogue regulatory agencies. And that's the campaign that I think the Republicans are going to really pursue aggressively, is pinning high prices on the federal government's overall regulatory policy. And that is a complete farce. And getting to Kevin's point about we need reg reform, I was quoted in a Greenwire story yesterday in talking about the Chamber of Commerce rolled out this report saying that 340-something energy projects were stalled, and this showed the need for comprehensive reg reform. And I made the point that the Chamber's multinational corporate members have been spoiled in China, where they get to enjoy the benefits of centralized planning where individuals have zero rights whatsoever. And so building energy projects in that kind of system is awesome if you're an energy company. It is a terrible situation if you're a landowner or an average citizen. I'm very glad that we're in the United States of America with a constitution that, you know what, sometimes energy companies don't always able to plan their projects nicely and get things done quickly, but that's the American system. And I would rather have those inefficiencies than the alleged efficiencies of the Chinese system. And so this war on regulations is going to be a huge fight. I think that's going to eclipse talk about ANWR or drilling or other things. I think it's really going to set up whether or not the Environmental Protection Agency can do its job protecting public health, or whether we're going to eviscerate those regs.
Well, what do you guys think? Is it the diligent folks at the desk?
I want Toby to go first.
Is it the diligent folks at the desks at EPA, or is it the diligent folks at the commodities desks at the trading centers around the world? You know, what is it that is driving up global oil prices?
Well, I was gonna say something really quickly, not about global, but Tyson brought up regulations and things like that. But there's something inherently flawed when it takes twice as long to approve an application than it does to complete one in the nuclear realm. Hmm. You have you know, all these engineering designs, all these, you know, different parts of it that take two and a half years to come up with, to file the application. But yet NRC sits on it could take 5 years. There's something inherently flawed with that. And I think that's what we have to address in that spec. But as far as global oil prices and things like that, it would be different. And I understand where some of the arguments are coming from, but unfortunately, I can't necessarily take the side of where the Republicans in the House and others are coming and blaming the EPA at this moment. It'd be different if you had an NSPS or different things for greenhouse gases for refineries right now. That will be. But that's not being. I would not assume that that's being factored into the price now.
It's not. No.
Oh, exactly. So that's not necessarily, you know, contributing to the price right now. It's just all this. As little as Libya contributes to the global oil economy, it just seems very weird that. You know, prices go up so much, okay. And it also seems. But hold on, and this is something that as you know, working for a former member of Congress that talked about speculation a lot. Last year during the oil spill, prices actually went down. and in your mind, it's sort of counterintuitive, and you wonder if you can bring them down when you're losing oil, and when you have all these things. Why does it?
Just keep baiting me. I'm gonna jump in. I was trying to walk around the speculation issue.
I know you can tie this together.
I'm going to
be a light speed crew, the diesel in Europe, and
Kevin, you know, I was trying to bring you out of your shell because well, like Tyson, you don't really speak a lot.
I know.
Everyone is way too shy. So come on, let's hear.
Okay,
let's open up.
Look, guys, in terms of reg reform, it's not the abolition of regs I'm talking about. It's exactly what Toby's talking about, and it's rationalizing those regs. To make them make sense, to actually try to do the right thing, not to give up regulating.
Harmonizing.
Well, a number of courts agreed with you recently on, you know, the time it takes to issue permits.
That does tie together, though, with what you mentioned, the NRC and the length of time it takes to permit in the name of safety. And a separate safety regulator for offshore drilling has the potential to do the same thing. Now, anyone who argues, Republicans, Democrats, and I'm thinking of Mary Landrieu specifically, that we're raising the oil price by not drilling is full of you-know-what, heavy sour crude, if you will. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that the problems are problems we've had for years, that we've made decisions. We wanted to export pollution. We wanted to save our own oil resources. We preferred to drill near our beaches instead of in some place where only caribou would care. We made a lot of decisions, and we have to live with those decisions. But the decisions that we're making now will affect us, and they'll affect us at a time when the world oil demand will be greater. Now, this speculation issue is valid. I'll say that again. Speculation is driving the price up higher than it should be right now, just like it drives it down lower than it should be when it corrects. The spot market premium in Europe, which is what really matters, what commercial refiners are paying above what they would ordinarily pay for the crudes that meet the specifications they need, is about $2 to $5 depending on the country and the crude. And the reason is that their refineries aren't working as well or as efficiently as ours do, and they can't make diesel fuel out of the oils that are coming from the Middle East as easily. So they have to get the better oil, and they bid up for it. Ordinarily, the U.S. would be moving in lockstep, but if you look at what's going on, we set price based on what's in inventory in Oklahoma, in Cushing, Oklahoma. And there's been a lot of oil coming down from North Dakota, but mostly we haven't been using oil because our refineries aren't working very hard, and that's because our economy isn't doing as well as people want to pretend it is. Now, what does that mean? It means that there's less for export here, and the prices do reflect different markets. We don't have the oil that we would ordinarily be using to turn into gasoline flowing through our refineries, so there isn't diesel bringing the price down for everyone in Europe. Now, Libya does matter in that context, but what are the speculators doing? The speculators are saying, we don't know what's going to happen next. We are bidding up on the basis of the view that this is a much more unstable situation than the facts on the ground suggest, and we are taking the cautionary route. Is that good or bad? You know, you can take a lot of views of this. In the public interest, no one wants high gasoline prices. But in a practical sense, anyone who lays in stores because they think that there's a cold winter coming is probably helping the market in the long run.
Yeah, but the fact is, I think we're overpaying this risk premium, and it really fundamentally threatens the very fragile economic recovery. And
I agree.
And the folks on Wall Street are making a lot of money right now. On this speculation, and I'm just saying that I think that we need to clarify the rules before the CFTC and start imposing some standards, some firm position limits, so that we don't have a small handful of banks driving the
CFTC.
Market.
Yeah, but there's always going to be speculation, and you know,
I'm not saying get rid of speculation.
Spinning off and trading on your own book is
you don't want to do that and drive capital out of the system.
Because it over to London.
What that money is doing, first of all, is giving the small producers, who in this country are responsible for the incremental supply, a way to sell forward into the market. And yes, they are selling forward at a price that benefits speculators, but it also benefits our energy security. And the reason that's important is that if they can't do it, the costs of producing wells up in formerly Democrat-run North Dakota, in the Bakken Shale, is very high. And the bottom line is that if you can't sell forward into a market rich with speculators, you're not going to take as much risk or produce as much oil. Same is true for the incremental supply in the outer continental shelf for the smaller companies, not the integrateds. The counterparty risk of losing those speculators from the market isn't necessarily going to lower prices, because some of the supply we actually have here won't be able to show up. It won't be sure that it's got a future.
And oil has, you know, of all the commodities, arguably the strongest and longest forward curve.
It got a lot stronger and a lot longer just in the last few weeks.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting here is the hemispheric characteristics of this debate. I mean, we have a global oil market where folks respond to global oil pricing, but the vast majority of our supply comes from Canada and then Mexico, and then Saudi Arabia is third and such. There's been a lot of talk lately about, you know, the Keystone Pipeline bringing oil down from the tar sands to where it could be refined, initially in the Dakotas, but then, you know, maybe even as far down as Port Arthur. Is a solution like that basically keeping that hemispheric focus, is that something that's going to work? And
on the heels of that question, Tyson, for a long time, folks have said in the environmental community, you know, quite accurately, we need to create massive efficiency gains in how we, you know, utilize petroleum products, in addition to finding, you know, new cleaner sources and such. There's been, you know, quite a bit of, you know, ground gain, not as much as some people would have liked to see in terms of fuel efficiency standards for our automotives here in the United States. You know, are we at a point where the environmental community can begin to take a position to say, look, there is room for some domestic drilling expansion. There is room for, you know, more of a hemispheric strategy, even if it involves things with a carbon intensity as the Canadian tar sands?
No, I don't, because I don't think that we've exhausted our options on our alternatives to our addiction to oil. First of all, I've been up to Fort McMurray in Alberta, and I've personally toured the Suncor facility. And I didn't get a management tour. I got a tour from the union. And so we went with the workers and the trucks and went to places that management definitely would not have taken us. And it is an absolute environmental nightmare. Not only the carbon footprint, but what is going on in terms of the strip mining operation and everything else involved with tar sands. It is not something that is consistent with the goals of addressing climate change or leaving our land and water in a better place than we found it. And in terms of will environmentalists, in light of high energy prices, and to try to avoid the carbon intensity and environmental problems of tar sands, support expansion of conventional drilling in the United States? No, I don't. Because expanding conventional drilling, as the Bush administration's Energy Information Administration concluded in 2007, opening up all offshore areas to new drilling would have an insignificant impact on prices and imports. What we need to do is to really finance the sustainable revolution we need by repealing all the oil company tax breaks, enacting a windfall profits tax, and turning that money immediately into a huge expansion and extension of tax credits and other incentives to help working families afford to buy hybrid vehicles and other fuel-efficient cars. And we really need the federal government to step in and give a lot more financial assistance to municipal and county governments to expand and sustain their mass transit systems. It's going to be baby steps. It's going to be a while, but we have to start making those investments today so that we're better prepared for tomorrow's price shock.
I don't disagree. You know, I think
exactly.
I think I just swallowed my
tongue. I think one of the first times we did this program, I alluded to the flashy new thing, that it seems Congress always does a flashy new thing, whether it's ethanol, then it was hydrogen, then it was the electric vehicle, and it's always what's the next, you know, big thing, and we never set a course.
Wall Street's usually into it too.
Exactly. And Kevin. But we do need to, whether it's in the transportation sector, whether it's in the electric sector, we need to start looking at how we're going to transform our economy and transform our infrastructure and start going down that road. And we're not going to reduce our dependence on foreign oil as much as people, you know, everybody talks about energy independence. What, 69% of our oil comes from foreign sources?
About 60 at this point.
About 60? So to think that we're going to reduce that to negligible amounts is in the near future is ridiculous. It's just like saying we're going to get rid of coal in the near future. We're not.
But Tyson raises an interesting point here that, you know, folks are looking at energy subsidies with increased scrutiny in today's, you know, era of austerity. And, you know, there's long been a successful link that's been developed in the public's eye about how especially oil companies are taxed and such, and the what happens at the price of the pump. And it's very, you know, politically it's long been easy to say, well, if you do anything to me here, any part of this industry, your gas price is going to go up, and your constituents are going to get, you know, going to get angry. There's been a lot of talk for a long time about taking a hard look at the subsidy environment and such in the oil industry, but can that happen politically? I mean, the closest relationship beyond turning on the light switch
that we have the energy is when we get in our cars and trucks to go to work.
No, it can not only happen, it will happen. If you look at who the Tea Party, for that matter, the House Republicans are, they're not the last batch of Republicans. These folks do not come from oil-producing states. They don't come from states where multinational oil companies are domiciled. They come from energy-consuming states, and they are defenders of the energy consumer. John Boehner is currently carrying water for essentially the Republican view that globalism is good, but ask him to defend. First of all, how many times are you going to hear John Boehner say extraterritorial income tax? I haven't heard him say it once, but go back to Ohio with $4.50 gasoline and explain why you're giving a subsidy, or what looks like a subsidy, to international oil companies to produce overseas. Frankly, it's fair, and it's in the public interest, but explain that we have dual taxation in this country to the average voter, and you lost them at it's fair.
What you're neglecting to remember is that the Supreme Court Citizens United case is already unleashing record amounts of corporate money into the political system. And it doesn't matter what the good principles of some of the Tea Parties are, because they want to win re-election, because they like being in Congress.
The fact is that the oil industry
is digging in its heels and drawing a line in the sand and saying, we are going to fight to the death to keep our subsidies. And I don't see that the Tea Party is going to jump on board.
Let me first of all say, I'm offering you, in the laboratory of ideas, an idea that the Tea Party isn't defending big oil, and we'll see it if the price is high enough for long enough. Second, I'm suggesting to you that there's nothing like the oil company digging in their heels. What they'll do is exactly what they've done before. They're mobile. They move. And they will go and they will leave the American consumer behind because they are beholden to the American shareholder who owns their common equity. And they will go find higher value opportunities where there's less regulatory risk.
They're going to leave the third largest crude oil producing nation in the world and
No, they won't leave it entirely. They will leave the ongoing production from existing assets will continue. But the incremental growth that could buy us lower prices and energy security will go elsewhere. And when you talk about North American energy security like it's just another foreign country, it's not. All right, we are not worried about Mexican Revolution. It happened. We lived. We're not worried about the Canadians. If anything, we should probably be invading them. What we're worried about...
Annexing.
Sorry.
Taking their comedians.
They're already here. So are their winter athletes.
I know.
But the issue...
Well, it's a huge... It's a huge country. I mean, that's part of...
We can leave Quebec behind. Besides, we need to flood them for the hydro. But the
I was baiting you.
just so you know. Crehu. The bottom line... It's clean energy, though, isn't it? The bottom line here is that we are, in fact, giving subsidies to all energy in proportion, though, on a per BTU basis. What the Obama administration counts as about $4 billion a year is for 85%. Of our energy, okay, and the $12 to $19 billion for clean energy is for about 7% if you count ethanol, and it just doesn't make sense. If you're going to strip subsidies, then strip them equally and let the market work it out. And I think the oil companies would probably back it.
I don't think the oil companies are going to back anything that will lose ground in terms of their tax breaks or anything else. We saw the American Petroleum Institute almost single-handedly block what was very sensible offshore drilling reform legislation last summer. This remains a very powerful interest that is extremely mobilized to retain their billions of dollars in tax breaks. And I don't see that the Republican Party is really committed to going after corporate tax breaks. They are committed after redefining government spending as something that is... contributing to the economic crisis.
You don't think they'd want to go after $6 billion in ethanol subsidies?
I thought they were.
Yeah, they already did. There was.
And if you can see that, then why
$6 billion in wind subsidies a year?
Yeah. Well, they're going to go after everything. But when push comes to shove, you are not going to see the oil industry because they are going to. They've already. The American Petroleum Institute already had their big press event in January,
and that's where
they
the point.
Where they defined it as. Jobs. And if you take away our tax, if you take away our tax breaks, you will reduce the workforce, and that's the way they're defining it instead of an equity.
And you are the smartest environmentalist out there. You know all the same facts. You just use them differently as anybody on the oil company's side. Tell me what you think it means that the Republicans win the House of Representatives and theoretically obviate the risk of any sort of tax rescission or modification and immediately hold an event in the first week of January where they say, don't tax us. And they trot out Fred Upton. They sit him there at the – were you at the event?
No.
Okay. Well, you should have been. It was great. He was at the museum at the top floor. It was really nice up there.
It's good comedy.
It is.
But, you know, the deal is that they have the guy, basically, who's supposed to be their exponent, and then they ask him, in front of everybody, please help us get access to here in a stable economy where we can make long-term investments, and please don't tax us. Doesn't that jump out at you and go and say, wow, the oil industry recognizes that this isn't business as usual, that we're in 1979, and they got to be careful.
Well, let me ask this to you
guys.
And
then there's Joe Barton, who says that without public subsidies, Exxon would go bankrupt.
Well, let me ask this to you guys.
Who is that again?
The challenge that the renewables industry has faced and much of the clean energy industry has faced is that their tax incentives have sunsetted. They are temporary. They are, excuse the pun, renewable. And that with the traditional conventional tax incentives, in particular for upstream oil production and such, they have been permanent residents of the tax code for a long, long time.
Some of them not so long. The manufacturing credit is what, 2004?
2004. But a lot of them have been permanent. Is this just an issue where? I heard one person describe it, that the renewables tax incentives, it's one of those things where it's cyclical. Folks understand it's really horrible in a boom and bust cycle for the industry that it creates, but it's wonderful for politicians to be able to roll back in and talk about what they've just done for the new growing clean energy economy every few years by supporting X, Y, and Z before it was about to go and all these jobs were going to be lost. Can we get to a point where we have the Tea Party coming in to Congress? I happen to agree with Toby and Kevin on the fact that they are really a wild card. We have Senator Bingaman announcing retirement. We have Murkowski, who came in on a write-in, beholden to very
no
few.
One.
Very, very
no
few.
Certainly nobody on the hard right.
Yeah, so certainly no one on the hard right. You know, we have an environment where, you know, there have been instances where we've seen the House GOP side with the Obama administration. You know, is there enough of a wild card where folks could take an honest look at the subsidy environment?
I mean, the budget debate in the House was a prime example. How many times have you ever seen freshmen go against the leader for a project in his district that's being done by a huge company? You know, I was once told that you could sign a contract with that big company, it could be the worst in the business, and you would never get in trouble. Whereas if you sign a great contract with another less known company, you know, something can happen. But to cut that, for all those members to cut that, that shows you that there's nothing that's not off limits. I think that with all this talk, what about talk of all this, you know, corporate tax reform? You know, I was told by someone because I had to go down and talk to my tax department, and I said, if you were me, what would you tell my tax department to start looking at and working on? And the answer was pretty succinct, and it was like, they're playing with live bullets. Figure out what's important and what you're willing to defend and what's not. And I think that's going to be across the board. Is that the most important thing for the industry?
Well, I definitely agree with you that there are elements of the Tea Party that I actually respect a great deal, because it is really grassroots in nature, and that's what freaks the Chamber of Commerce out, because they want people that they can reliably bribe in a legal way.
Come on.
That's politics, man. Come on. That is the way the system
everybody,
works.
Everybody's a special
interest. And the fact is that nobody in the business world likes these Tea Party wild cards. And the Chamber of Commerce is already operating like a third political party, and they are going to be playing an extremely active role thanks to the Citizens United decision. And you cannot understate the radical impact that decision has on the future of our democratic republic. It's huge, and this Tea Party movement, I think, is fledgling, and it is not going to be sustainable because it doesn't have a coherent voice outside of cut everything and get rid of all programs. there isn't a cohesive unifying force that will sustain it election after election, especially because the base that is responding to that will become disillusioned.
Yeah, and what happens if you do balance the budget?
Yes, there is. All right. If Facebook, which I thought was just for trying to get together with your old high school sweetheart without your wife finding out, can cause a revolution. If that can cause a revolution or foment or facilitate revolution in highly polarized, highly centralized governments overseas, don't forget what the internet can do for you here at home in our free society. Yeah. Internet memory is permanent. One of the things that's characterized the last three congressional elections is populism. The first two were anti-corporate. The third one was anti-government. But populism isn't a political ideology, nor is it a corporate or individual definition. It's a question of who's in power and are they treating you fairly. The Tea Party rode that wave. It did not ride the wave of multinational politics. It did not ride the wave of what I think is sensible and worth defending, foreign direct investment in the United States. It rode the wave of emotion. And to get reelected, that emotion is going to be what the members who've been elected will be relying on. But there's video telling everybody what they were going to do. Yeah. And if they don't do it, they lose and they know it. And their existential choice is going to become September 30 of 2011. Do they or do they not go to the brink? And our call is they go to the brink.
Is it a wave that can be surfed, though? I mean, honestly, there are a lot of folks who tried to surf that wave over the last few years in climate issues in particular. You saw the cap and trade, you know, cap and dividend bill was a board that tried to get on that wave. You've seen a lot of folks try to get on that wave. But the core question here is can an ideologically based movement, can it address and interlock with complex resource-based energy politics? Do the two go together?
Not with Michelle Bachmann as the spokesperson, or even Sarah Palin. You need to have a credible intellect who can resonate with a genuine populist message, and the Tea Party has neither.
I vote for Tyson Slocum.
Well, it really is a fascinating point, because Citizens United decision certainly opened the monetary floodgates to special interests across the board. But I mean,
for unions as well. But
right. Yeah, but the Kevin's point, which is a great.
But it's
one.
No comparison when you look at the spending.
You used to ask the question on who could buy the most television ads between the hours of 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock, and that person was then able. That person, you know, was then theoretically able to get in front of most of the public's eye, and therefore was able to make their money flow more readily. Now, if between those hours people are sitting watching TV with their iPad in front of them, you know, their kids are next to them, surfing and talking to someone on Xbox Live, you know, they're texting, you know, and Twittering and so on. I mean, are we at a point now where, you know, you could say that there's enough access where everyone can grab a loudspeaker that, well, albeit the magnitudes are not, you know, completely reversed or changed and shifted in terms of what money does in politics, is it at least mitigated, Tyson?
No, I mean, then the internet, look, we're a Public Citizen is a grassroots organization. We rely heavily on the internet and email lists to get word out to our members and activists. But those are people that are already engaged. When you are able to passively engage a huge audience by showering it with a message like the American Petroleum Institute does, softening the public on defining to them who oil companies are and give them a warm, fuzzy feeling, so then when you start talking about getting rid of their tax breaks, people say, well, wait. It's the people of the oil and gas industry. Why do I want to take tax breaks away from people? This isn't a multinational corporation. Because the oil companies, contrary to what Joe Barton says, are awash in record profits and don't need a couple of billion dollars in tax breaks a year to engage in domestic production or refining. The market price of crude oil and other energy products is providing all the incentive. Meanwhile, we've got huge needs for alternative sustainable energy infrastructures that are way underfinanced, that are in bad need of that resources. And as you said, If when you look at the tax code, if it's for fossil fuels or nukes, they're large and permanent. If they're for renewables, they're temporary and large.
Reason. Let's just set the record straight here. If I have a lemonade stand, I can deduct my cost of expenses. Okay, my cost of goods sold is a deductible line. If I didn't make lemonade, if I did something that was more insubstantial, I would want some recompense for a substantial outlay that I could expense, and I could say, well, look at what I'm doing. Some of the tax issues that are being discussed here they shouldn't even be up for grabs. Some of them, I agree, are totally debatable. Let's start with the ones that aren't. For the stuff that's been on the books forever, it's about how business runs, on working capital. And you want to maximize working capital throughput for something you like. You don't take away the IDC deduction if you want domestic production. You can take it away if you don't. You don't take away percentage depletion if you want domestic production. Take it away if you don't. On the other hand, there are other things that are more complicated and, frankly, like the Section 199 credit, very subjective and short-lived. We think those are at risk for that reason. There are some that are hard to explain, like extraterritorial income tax and dual capacity taxpayer status. We think those are at risk for that reason. But what do we want as a policy? Well, we know these companies are multinationals and that they have a goal, and that goal is to maximize revenue for shareholders, and they'll do it wherever they can. And stability with regard to tax regime is an important way to keep them here, employing people here. The thing about the IDCs that's changed is that it used to be that if you were taking them away, you were hurting little companies. Now taking them away hurts some of the biggest companies in the world. But hurts them how? Hurts them in a way that they sit on a resource that we need produced and don't employ people we need employed. Why on earth would we want to do that?
You're telling me that an oil company is not going to pursue a project with oil at $100 a barrel.
They're not going to pursue a gas project with gas at $3.80 unless they have that tax credit. And we could probably use that natural gas for a measure of comfort, freedom, and economic recovery. I'm not for or against anything. I mean, these are dynamics.
Well, and the only reason this is coming up right now is because it's such tight economic times. And you know, you could make the argument that, you know, take the production tax credit, the investment tax credit, the 1603 Treasury cash grant for renewables. If you put those in place permanently, or at least for a long enough period of time in the future to drive more investment, wouldn't you be able to make the case that the economic growth created would drive enough revenues that we wouldn't have to pitch people in the energy sector against each other?
I think you should do that. I think those credits should be permanent.
Well, then can we stop talking about a mandatory program that would require utilities to have to do that?
I would think that would be the logical extension of having permanent tax support, would be that you didn't tell people how to run their business.
Right.
Now, are you referring to the clean energy standard that's been proposed?
It goes back to the ethanol stuff too. Why would you incent through the tax code something that you're mandating over here?
Belt and suspenders? You ever seen a fat guy?
The carrot and the stick, I guess, is the argument. But it's a lot easier to mandate something if the financials work out on that something.
Or if you've got a really good lobbying campaign the way the ethanol industry has had. And it was one of the credits I give to the Tea Party is they went after it and got an amendment passed, stripping it. And
well,
now that's going to be retained in the Senate.
There's bipartisan talk in the Senate.
And right, you've got Cardin and Coburn sponsoring.
That's
a great pair.
Conrad saying, if Conrad, I haven't read the article, but if Conrad's saying it, that's something.
He's saying keep the RFS and lose the VEETC.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you ask what is the more interventionist, less market-based choice, it's I'd rather see a subsidy for an insurance policy, which in 08 ethanol worked. Saved our way of life, whether you want to admit it or not. Oil companies, by the way, made a pile selling ethanol and gasoline that year and didn't mind a bit. That tax credit bought us access to light product that we couldn't get in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want it to be everything to everybody, it's not. Now, the RFS is a obligation that makes no sense. It's an absolute volumetric requirement, and we have all our other requirements on a percentage basis. It conflicts with logic, but it reflects a great deal of good politics. So what is the what
it's
do you want?
Much easier to tune a volumetric requirement than a percentage-based one. Tune it up, tune it down.
But it's not tuned.
No, but it basically allowed you to when the original RFS was passed in 2005, the intent was to say if it makes economic sense to do it in Illinois and fulfill your mandate in Illinois as opposed to trying to spread it out across the country, it's easier to do that.
Yeah. Remember, Iowa or things like that. So you're not mandated across.
No,
but like
true.
CES, you're. I mean, it's a one-size-fits-all for everyone across.
Fuels are more flexible than power. You pay for power where you live.
Right. Getting to the clean energy standard that Obama kind of threw out on his State of the Union, what I really saw that as was he knew that there was going to be a looming fight over EPA regulations, and he was desperate to have something there that could take the place of EPA. So he's looking for a deal to get a CES in exchange for
preemption.
That
I agree with that totally.
And
yeah, but if you look at it and you take the models, the EPA models from Waxman-Markey and the American Power Act and things like that, and look at the dispatch in 2040, sort of aligns with what he's
like
pretty much.
He's asking for the same thing twice.
He's basically he's done the right
but
thing.
But he's doing what Tyson said.
This should have been talked about before cap and trade and things like that. And there were a lot of moderate Democratic members that said the problem was we focused too much on the environment first, and everybody ran away instead of focusing on the technology first and let the environmental attributes.
And now, you know, climate change wasn't uttered once in the State of the Union.
Chris,
you've got Democrats with their consultants saying, don't talk about climate change, talk about clean energy standards.
Technology development.
Chris and I testified, I believe, on the subject of the idea that you, at least when I was sitting next to you, I know what I said. I don't know if I remember what you said. It was smart, though. It was something, I don't remember. The effect of start with one sector and start with one that's regulated, start with one that doesn't, we can use as a test bed. There's nothing wrong with cap and trade. Cap and trade is a great way to be efficient. It has to be done right. There's nothing wrong with markets. Markets, even markets with non-commercial traders, can be efficient and for the public interest. I was arguing that, you know, carbon tax is better, but best of all, was what Obama has finally come back to, which is start with a sector that's already captive, and let's work with that sector and figure out how to do it. But what he's doing, Toby, is exactly what I think Tyson has suggested he's doing. He's saying, we see what's coming up. We've pulled the lever and let EPA loose. And just like the Bush administration, look what happened to that leak on the fracking article to the New York Times. They can't put the dog back in the cage. So what they want is they want Congress involved, but they want to make sure that they take home something in return. Mm-hmm. Whether it's a 3P bill or just a preemption, there's a coal plant problem. And what the Obama administration has said is fine. You can have a rescission. You can have a block, but we want this too. It's a deal. I mean, we started here on this program talking at the beginning of the year about where this thing might start, and when we talked about the power sector, we're back there even though oil prices are high.
And the power sector was, you know, in the let's call it, you know, one of the most significant positions of support that it's ever been in around environmental regulations when looking at what Kerry Lieberman, Graham, Waxman-Markey, and so on, where things were headed on at least a frameworks basis. And then the election came, and you saw an interesting divide where more of the ideological, you know, anti-big government interest and focus all of a sudden was butting heads with the industry that was going to be regulated itself, but saw it as a way to, you know, transform. Well, what's fascinating is that the response, and I think you guys actually pointed it out, is to take what would have happened under a cap-and-trade regime where you put a cost to the performance of certain types of generating units and instead said, no, we're going to look at ways to incentivize and require the nature of the unit itself to shift over time. I mean, that's really what a CES is. You could say it's a grand vision study or kind of vision study level, to use power industry parlance, of an integrated resource plan for the nation. It says, you know, we want to go in this direction. All these suites of technologies, you know, could play. We think that they all, for various reasons, have good performance that we like for different reasons, but they all share certain clean characteristics. And guess what? We can pass that in place, talking about jobs and growth and building new things and putting new steel in the ground, but not talk about the environment. And that's been the most significant shift I think I've seen, is that, you know, last year we were talking about the environment. You know, towards the end of last year into this year, it is not mentioned. It's not coming up in the debate. But as folks have pointed out, you know, it's the same coin, it's just the other side.
Right. But I think the challenge is, while definitely the rhetoric has changed, the problem is that the geographic differences that make up the American political system that are very unique to energy policy. Everybody's got their own definition, depending on where you are in the United States, of what should be in the clean energy standard. You've got division among the environmental groups, and at the end of the day, the American people are not going to be enthusiastic about it. I think we need to go back to, you know, Public Citizen played a big role. You'd mentioned earlier talking about cap and dividend, and that was our preferred method of choice in talking about climate change, was sending a monthly check to folks or slashing their payroll tax, however you want to structure it. And we worked closely with the offices of Maria Cantwell and Susan Collins. It was the only bipartisan climate bill in the United States Senate, you know, aside from Lindsey Graham and whatever the heck he was doing last year. But the fact is that that's the thing that Obama campaigned on that really got people interested, because it was an energy policy that spoke to them, because what speaks to people is money.
There was only one wrong thing with that bill. Because I thought it was...
Only one. I can point out one real quick.
I think it's the same one, I suspect. The pure principle of the Cantwell-Collins bill was that you were going to tax carbon when it entered the economy and rebate back that tax to folks who needed rebates. I don't think anyone, not oil companies, not power companies, disagree with that. Where they disagree was with the anti-derivatives portion of that bill.
I was proud of the anti-derivative.
Yeah, I know you were, but it's because it hasn't been explained in a non-toxic
way.
But not
every derivative is a credit default swap.
But in this context, what you want your power companies to be able to do is to be able to write derivatives against their carbon shares so they can hedge fuel cost risk very effectively. You don't let the first buyer of the carbon share actually have a way to modulate that risk, then they are totally captive to whatever someone else in the market does to bid up the price of the share, and they can't do anything if the price of coal rises at the same time.
So would you agree to an amendment that would say restrict participation in a derivative market only to those entities that have a share in the carbon credit?
No, although I think you could...
So the primary users.
No, I don't... Well, that's the problem. If you take all the non-commercial capital out, you clearly have a problem. If you have it all the way in, you leave yourself open to speculative peaks. I think there's a middle ground. The sulfur program was a commercial-only program initially and worked fine. It didn't get hurt by having speculators in it either. There's a middle ground here, and it could be reached very effectively. I wouldn't say take all the non-commercials out. You don't want that. You want to sell forward. You want to give stability to the market. Everyone assumes that they cause volatility, but take them out, and you don't have the depth of the futures curve. You can't do it.
And it's my problem with the cap and dividend was it's just like the CES. It looks great from a distance, and it sounds great until you start looking at it. But as I've said around this table and in many other forums, what you're essentially doing is taking $10 away from an Indiana consumer, $5 away from a California consumer, giving them both back $7 and saying, you're equal. You both got back $7. Well, when in reality, it's not equal.
Well, we met with a lot of Midwestern Republicans and Democrats, and there was definitely the beginnings of discussions about recalculating the formula, the dividend formula. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Public Citizen would be open to doing.
But not necessarily the sponsors.
Yeah. Right, look, the monolithic one-size-fits-all is stupid because I have all the data anyone ever needs to compile about how it's different in different states. And whatever the formula is, compensating in proportion to the cost to the – you also have to look at the denominator, right? The disposable income at a state level matters a lot too. There's ways to do this right. We've actually got a lot of government actuaries who've been able to manage benefits from government programs without screwing it up horrendously. They do cost of living indices for government programs pretty effectively, last I checked.
You know, that's sad when the qualifier is horrendously.
You know, when
well, it's realistic, at least.
They've been able to do it, but not horrendously.
It's interesting because the complexity you have in what goes into the consumer's energy bill in the rate equation and such, it makes it, you know, all the more reason why it's hard to, you know, say everyone is going to get back at this rate, even if you adjust it. That was part of the arguments that folks made for how the allocation eventually was done in Waxaw-Markey and so on. And we've actually seen a number of public utility commissions around the country, you know, in the last year or so, get much more budget conscious. The consumer advocates getting much more you know, getting a much stronger hand in how they've looked at rate setting and rate recovery on behalf of utilities. You know, many folks out there are continuing to make the argument that, you know, allowing in that complex relationship of what a utility is investing and what a ratepayer is paying, allowing a public utility commission to understand what carbon costs are coming in, what they're being given to help, you know, ease those costs for the consumer, and then what ultimately passes through the consumer, giving them the authority to say, you know what, we're going to bear some of the costs now and then ease it up, or to, you know, allow more allowances to enter and be used and less carbon costs to pass through if other aspects of the rate are spiking and so on. That's been a debate that's been going on. And the thing is, though, is at least for the time being, that debate is dead. Whether it's going to be cap and dividend or cap and trade, the focus is now on the flip side of the coin, on what is the resource composition, and in particular, what kind of jobs are going to drive that resource composition now and into the future. And we have a wild card Congress. I mean, that's really one of the things I think is most significant. With the Tea Party, with leadership in the Senate that are not, frankly, beholden to many folks, with the regionalism and the complexity of energy politics.
With a lot of veteran senators leaving?
Exactly.
Can I add one element?
Sure, please.
With a president who raised the vast majority of his money without his party.
Yeah.
When we look at the internet as a differentiating factor, let's not forget that Barack Obama isn't just the first African American president. He's got a really distinguishing characteristic relative to all of the campaigns that have happened in the last couple of decades. He's moved in a way that Ross Perot dreamed of moving, but in a way that isn't obviously creepy. It's not.
What are you saying?
Who am I and what am I here? I'll be stuck to you for right. What's going on here is a president who doesn't have to be beholden to the Democratic Party can actually pull them along with him because of that. It creates a lot of wild cards.
If he can galvanize the public the way he did in his first campaign, and he was cashing in on Bush fatigue and the promise of expectations, just like the Tea Partiers were riding the wave of expectations of change. Everybody wants change. Conservatives, liberals, mm-hmm. people are not happy. There's profound economic insecurity. People are worried about the direction the country's going. And there's dissatisfaction and alienation with Obama, just like there will be with the Republican Party. And Obama was incredible, like you say, at raising a ton of small contributions outside of the party network. Will he be able to do that again, given the people's kind of opinion of him at this point? Maybe he can. Well, he's a great campaign.
Yeah, do you have the turnout in 2012 mm-hmm. as you had back when everybody was – it was a new thing? Again, I go back to my shiny new object.
If Sarah Palin's running for the Republicans, you'll get Obama money from me.
That's Obama's saving grace, is that the Republican primary system is so captive to some wacky folks that their ability to put together a credible candidate is going to be a challenge.
Well, one thing that is certain, it's a lot less clear than it was just 2 months ago. And we are going to be facing a summer where these issues are going to be coming up pretty hot and heavy, because people are going to be feeling at the pumps on their vacations, when they drive to work, and so on. And few things hit the pocketbook more than that. Cascades in every aspect of our economy, from the food we eat to, you know, the goods that we buy and have delivered, everything. And so we will have, in my opinion at least, what I call an energy summer here on Capitol Hill. Well, we'll see where it goes, and we'll see if the traditional links between the transportation sector and the electricity sector, that old ball of wax that when gas prices go up, the door is open to look at everything, if that continues, or if we're going to start to see issue separation, compartmentalization. I think it's hard. I think that once the energy box is open, everyone jumps in with the issues, because there are issues across the board. And that's one thing I think everyone can agree on, is that wherever you're looking at the energy value chain in this country, there's a heated debate and questions as to what we should be doing at each segment. With that, we're going to wrap up. On behalf of everybody involved in bringing you the Hot Air Show, thanks for listening. Looking forward to having you join us next time in the heat.